Hello, and welcome to episode 64 of Must See Matches, the essential of pro wrestling as nominated by you. I am Kieran Lefort, and joining me as always, the man behind Must See Matches, Mark Buckley. Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Had a nice little short walk before recording.
Get yourself into a Ring of Honor headspace.
The good old days.
Joining us this week, proving that we do in fact know more than two female wrestling fans, but only one's called Alex or Sarah, it's Sarah Flan. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me. And it's okay. We're token women on... Sometimes, you know, branch out. There needs to be different names. Sarah is that like wrestling. I might change my name, to be honest, and be a bit different. That's a bit later down the line. Too much paperwork, but... Thank you for having me.
It's the same as how most male wrestling fans are called Chris or Daniel, I've discovered.
Yeah, it must be a thing with the, once you get assigned a name at birth, it's like, okay, this is what you're going to like now. You're like wrestling and you're going to have to live with it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
I mean, I was tarred and feathered. After all, I'm nothing but a mark.
Perfect.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Yeah. Straight from the off.
Good Lord. He actually made a good joke. Right. So. I'm going to ask you, Sarah, how did you become a wrestling fan in the first place?
I became a wrestling fan because I have two older brothers who were in their late teens in the Attitude Era, and I'm a little bit younger than them. So I was just surrounded by wrestling all the time, The Rock, Stone Cold in my household. But then when I actually started watching, and it would have been Raw that was aired on Friday nights, I think, Chris Jericho was actually my, this guy is really good. I was captivated by the shiny jacket, the really blonde hair. And I was really just hooked from then on out. I think most people kind of have that phase where they stop watching wrestling. But for me, it's been constant now, I'd say, since 1999, to be honest.
Mm. So I haven't even mentioned the match we're talking about today. It's Bryan Danielson versus Takeshi Morishima from Ring of Honor Manhattan Mayhem 2, August 25th, 2007. Do you have a particular affinity for Ring of Honor of this period?
It's funny, I didn't at the time because I actually wasn't watching. It was only when I really got into independent wrestling, I'd say in 2008, 2009, that I kind of was introduced to the world of Ring of Honor. It's so funny because it was when it was on HD Now, it was when I started watching, which is like the downfall.
Yeah, yeah. I ended up watching that fairly regularly as well. It was sort of like a nice little packaged hour of wrestling every week, wasn't it?
Yeah. Sticking along, but then you realize, and everyone's like, this is the downfall of Ring of Honor. You're like, I better go back and watch it when it was actually good. And I think that's what happened to me.
And what would be your favorite stuff to watch? Like if you're on a desert island, you can have your favorite wrestling. What would it be?
Oof. I would say I'm staring at all my DVDs burning down now. Which ones? I know everything's digital, but you know, DVDs have value now.
Of course.
Yeah, I think honestly that era of Ring of for me, obviously then that, you know, iconic era of New Japan from like 2013 to 2018. And then lots of division from TNA, I'd say, were kind of the three different pockets, if I could just take all of that.
Mark, you have very often professed to be a big fan of Ring of Honor. Were you watching along at this time?
This was the time where I was paying a lot of attention. So I probably started buying DVDs in 2006. Yeah, 2006 was when I started buying DVDs. 2007, I went to the first Ring of Honor show, which was Unified. And by 2008, I was flying out almost every year for about a 5 year period. I went to three or four WrestleManias for mostly the Ring of Honor shows and the friends I met through Ring of Honor. And I'd also, at this time, had also gotten into Noah a bit because Noah was on the Wrestling Channel. Right. Plus there was the Noah links with Ring of Honor because the year prior to this year, 2007, we're talking about, in 2006, they had Kenta and Marufuji for regular periods of time. And then this year, 2007, it was the big Takeshi Morishima excursion. But yeah, no, a lot of people will say this is kind of the year when Ring of Honor's glory period fell off. I'd argue that 2007 is still within that peak, but you have different people arguing, like, is 2005 or 2004 the start? Is 2007 or 2008 the end? It's different people have got different takes.
Well, as we just discussed, it fell off once they hit HDNet, right? So we're going to be covering a lot of Brian Danielson on this show. And as he is still very active and prominent in the year 2023, we probably don't need to talk that much about him. But, Mark, can you explain who Takeshi Morishima is, like, up to this point?
So Takeshi Morishima was, he debuted in 1998, and he was part of All Japan back when Mitsuharu Misawa and all of that ilk were there. Mm-hmm. When Misawa decided to leave and create Noah, Morishima joined him. And Morishima was part of a great class, well, not class because they weren't from the same years, but there was a great group of guys that were all had a lot of potential in Noah in like the early to mid 2000s. So you have Morishima, they had high hopes for Takeshi Rikio. You in the juniors, you had Naomichi Marufuji and Kenta. And then behind them, you had guys like Takashi Sugiura.
Yeah, they're not so much a class. They're just sort of like a group of contemporaries bubbling under, aren't they?
Yeah. Mm. So they weren't all, they didn't all start at the same time, but they were coming close to their peak around similar times. Mm. The thing is, as we probably mentioned previously, All Japan was a heavyweight only promotion. The juniors division in All Japan really didn't matter to the fans. And while Misawa made it his goal to rehabilitate the junior division in Noah, and Marufuji and Kenta were a big part of it, there was still a sense that for the top guy, you have to be a heavyweight.
Mm.
So Noah had a couple of guys that they had targeted as like, he'll be our next big heavyweight. The first one up was Takeshi Rikio, who defeated Kenta Kobashi, ending Kobashi's infamously great Noah reign.
Hmm.
And that fell flat on his face, and Rikio ended up retiring about 5 or 6 years later, and he never really hit the level they hoped. So Morishima was basically, he was next in line. So Noah had Go Shiozaki around 2007. Go Shiozaki had debuted, I think it was 2005, and he was like the next one after Morishima. So Morishima's in this position of, he's going to be the next guy that you think is going to get the title who hasn't held it previously. They experimented with Naomichi Marufuji in 2006. And as we discussed in the Marufuji Kenta episode, Noah basically looked at the numbers on the houses and basically said, no, we're ending this. Like,
yeah, it was great quickly. Matches, poor numbers, wasn't it?
And I kind of think that this Morishima Ring of Honor run was kind of designed to give Morishima that single top guy experience for when he would get an eventual title run. Mm. So he joined Ring of Honor, I think it was for January or February, and his first match was Samoa Joe. Pretty soon after, he beat Homicide to become the Ring of Honor heavyweight champion and the first non-US-based champion. Mm. So I think all of the champions up to that point had actually been American. Trying to think, I don't think any of them were Canadian. So he's the first foreign champion, and he had up to this point, he had a pretty dominant run. So he'd already had 15 title defenses before this.
Before this match?
Yeah. This was his 16th title defense.
Good Lord.
In 6 months. Ring of Honor really packed it. They'd have like two title defenses a weekend often.
Mm.
And it's a mix of the who's who and the who's that. So you had defenses over BJ Whitmer, Kenta, Nigel McGuinness, Austin Aries, Shingo Takagi, Kazma, who's best known as Lord Tensai's manager in WWE, if you remember that run, Jay Briscoe, Roderick Strong, Jimmy Rave, Adam Pearce, and weirdly enough, two of the better defenses in this run, Claudio Castagnoli and Brent Albright, better known as Gunnar Scott to some people, from the WWF. Morishima having his better matches against heavyweights will come up in something that I'm going to mention afterwards, because it's actually referenced in Bryan Danielson's autobiography.
So I had not seen any of this before. This is entirely new to me. What is the story going into this match? Is it just Danielson has beaten enough people to be the next challenger?
In Ring of Honor, Danielson had had like an epic title run that pretty much covered from like the last couple of months, 2005, all the way to December 2006. Mm-hmm. It was second only to the Samoa Joe run. And the thing is, Danielson had basically hurt his shoulder like 3 months before he was due to drop the title. So he was essentially working with a bad shoulder injury. So he took 3 months off for the first 3 months of the year. Then he worked a Noah tour. So he only came back to Ring of Honor in May. Mm-hmm. So he's only been back working ROH 3 months before this. But I wouldn't say he had like a match to earn him the title, because with Ring of Honor, a lot of the title defenses, someone will win a couple of matches and then they get a shot. But yeah. Because, as I said, Ring of Honor, 15 title matches in 6 months, Ring of Honor did a lot of regular title matches, more than any other title except for like WWF on house shows.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. Like, there's like you're getting up towards like house show title defense schedule there, aren't you?
Yeah, so they didn't always have like strong storylines for why X is the next title.
Sure. And of course, it's Bryan Danielson. He's kind of weighted in Ring of Honor, I think.
Do you have any takes on that, Sarah?
Yeah, no, I think that's it. Like, Danielson had his kind of reign of terror, then ended quite suddenly. Well, I felt as nearly fell suddenly by Homicide. And then I think up to that point, the shortest run with the title to drop to Morishima then, it was only like 50-something days.
56.
So, yeah, so...
In actual fact, it ties with Loki, but CM Punk's first reign was 55 days. And James Gibson's reign was only 36. And all of those precede this Morishima reign we're talking about.
Of course. Yeah, I forgot about that.
I don't think James Gibson even remembers he was Ring of Honor world champion.
He's probably forgotten his whole little indie excursion in 2005.
Yeah.
And I think what made it so good was you had Danielson, who went on that absolute reign of terror and was a complete dick during it, and then kind of getting humbled by Homicide, and then having to kind of work up his way. And like you said, Morishima, probably a lot of B show defenses, I would say, in those 16 defenses beforehand. Danielson probably deserved it when it gets to the point, and he's coming in completely different now, kind of being like, well, I was the champion before. You're this new guy coming in who won the title after having one match in Ring of Honor, shocking the wrestling world. And now Danielson's like, well, I'm actually the top guy here. I can wrestle you whenever I want, but I do deserve this. Look at what I've done.
Yeah, and you say B-show defenses. I note on this card, this isn't the main event.
Yeah.
This goes on second last with a 2 out of 3 falls tag title match that goes on last, which is like great treatment of the world tag titles, but it's not Takeshi Morishima main eventer.
Yeah, and as Sarah said, with the B defenses, that's both the quality of the opponent, and ROH would often have, as I was saying, they're doing double shots, and usually the first show of the weekend is seen as the weaker ones.
Yeah.
Because ROH, if I remember correctly, they were always doing Friday, Saturdays.
Yeah, I get it. You could have a weaker lineup, but headline it with a world title match, so that like it seems like you're getting something for going to the B show.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
I get that. So, the match. In front of an extremely loud crowd in Manhattan, who pretty much start with, you're going to get your fucking head kicked in. I think everybody was cheering along with that. AEW audiences, please take note for the cadence.
Also, I want to point out that because I was fans with a lot of guys on the Ring of Honor message boards, I'm probably on first name basis with a quarter of that front row.
This wasn't one of the ones you went to, right? You weren't hanging out the back, were you?
No, I didn't go to this one. But what basically
not
one
Benno
of the
hiding
guys,
somewhere or anything like that.
No, I'm not hiding there. One of the guys in the front row, I did go to his wedding last year, and I counted a finger poke of doom for him after he got married.
See, he seems like he's the librarian of professional wrestling, but like, Mark has some travel stories, usually involving wrestling and weddings.
Or bears.
Or bears, yes. So, the opening of this is Danielson figuring out that he can bait Morishima to the middle of the ring and then chop away at him with kicks to the thigh. And for his part, when he gets in range, Morishima is grabbing knuckle locks to keep hold of the little guy and clubbing away at his back and shoulders with forearms. They exchange corner traps with Danielson using the leg kicks and talking of bears, Morishima just bear mauling Dragon with forearms. The difference is Danielson gets his shots in, obeys the ref when he's asked to break and backs out to the middle and then beckons to champ out for more. Morishima, though, whenever Danielson tries to leave the corner or just bounces out under sheer force of one of those forearms, grabs him, throws him back in and pounds on him some more. Like, he's really like taking advantage of his size advantage. It looks to be about here, around the 5 minute mark, that Morishima lands the punch that, shall we say, unplugs Brian Danielson's eye. Because from here on out, Danielson constantly has that eye closed and he's grabbing at it and favoring it. He still lets Morishima clobber him in that region, though.
So, in hindsight, that eye injury was a broken orbital bone and a detached retina that Danielson needed surgery on 2 days later.
Good God.
And in a sign of Brian Danielson in 2007, he was told to not do anything stressful for a month after that surgery. He wrestled 3 weeks later and he wrestled Morishima again.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I don't know what to say. Like, he's
indie pro wrestlers around 2006 to 2008 were not the smartest in hindsight.
No, I don't think so. And eventually we'll get to Nigel McGuinness, who I think is the epitome of that. Good God. I mean, I'm clutching my eye now.
And I think as well, like, Brian mentioned this in his book, that before the match there was like a meeting with Gabe and because they wanted Morishima to be a lot more aggressive in the matches, to come off like this big massive monster against Brian, that he's too soft, which is quite funny to think of working too soft in his matches. So this is what it now comes to him completely destroying his eye socket.
I mean, I don't know how to put this, really. Morishima, for people who haven't seen him, looks like somebody has waxed a giant teddy bear and put a teenage emo girl's haircut on top. And he doesn't... He looks like a soft, gentle, nice man, I think, which is part of the issue, which I think is part of like why they wanted him to play up and be a bit more violent. And I think there are points in this match where he doesn't seem comfortable with it.
Well, the story coming back, as Sarah said, to Brian Danielson's book, is the story is that Danielson didn't feel like Morishima was bringing it. So he actually upped the how hard he was kicking Morishima. Basically, he was kicking him as hard as he could to make him fight back, which led to those clubbing forearms, which led to the broken orbital bone. And supposedly, despite the fact this is what Danielson wanted, Morishima repeatedly apologized after the match for the injury. So again, that plays into the just a nice guy kind of thing at this stage of his career.
So he is starting to play the burly heel, though. So he repeatedly traps Danielson in corners and just batters him down to the mat, even hitting what can only be described as a rolling ass to the face. Outside, Morishima crushes Dragon's head between the sole of his boot and the barrier, which wouldn't surprise me if it had broken the other orbital bone. He then slightly feebly misses a running hip attack and looks a bit unsure as to what to do next. So Danielson, with no small amount of struggle, bundles him over the barrier and hits a wild springboard dive into the front row. I think he hits more fans than he does Morishima. Like, it's like his chest and head sort of hit Morishima, but the rest of him is like way out in seats C, D, and E on the front row.
I mean, the guy's done a springboard dive with one working eye.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt in that.
To that end, though, like, he gets one foot up on a chair and he gets the other up on the barrier and he raises his arm and he roars and his poses. But, like, beyond the pro wrestling sell, his face at that moment tells the story that he's having a rough time, I think.
Oh, at various points, like, in the first 5 minutes after the injury, you can just tell that he's really struggling with the pain. It's like he's almost crying at times.
Yeah, yeah. His face looks like he's crying. I mean, you can only speculate what's going on in his head. It's like, shit, I can't see out of one eye. Will I ever get my eyesight back? Does this mean my wrestling career is over? Can I make this one last good match before it is over? Like, the way and the amount Brian Danielson thinks about wrestling, even things like, am I selling this well enough to make it look good in the match? You know, those would be the kind of thoughts I think that would go through the head of Brian Danielson at this moment.
Mm.
He batters the leg some more with a slightly gormless looking Morishima having to be maneuvered around outside. He whacks the knee with the chair as well. When they get back inside, there's a top rope dropkick, only staggers Morishima back a couple of paces. Danielson ducks a wild swing and gets in a couple of kicks, but as he runs the ropes, Morishima, and there's no other way to put it, fucking lamps him with a turning lariat. In my freeze frame, to write that note, Brian Danielson was still upside down.
The Morishima turning lariat is one of his calling cards. It's like, it's a move he did a lot. There's very few wrestlers that do it, and with the combination of Morishima's size and sort of the sudden speed of the turn, it's a really lovely spot.
It's a Carnarf shift for a big lad spot, isn't it?
And that was his reputation, was that
he
could move. He would occasionally do like top rope missile drop kicks.
He does in this match, in fact, later on. And I also noticed that he's got quite a wide arc on the swing and Danielson is not super close to him. So instead of getting the forearm, Daniel mostly gets the wrist and the fist across the neck and the jaw. So it's like, it's largely like just another big punch to the face.
Yeah.
He then goes for the lamest hip attack I think I've ever seen, softly jumping backwards about an inch off the mat, allowing Dragon to Owen Hart and kick his leg out of his leg. I quite like Danielson's cartwheel into the leg lock, but the referee thinks it's a cover and Brian doesn't quite have his foot in the right place. So there's a bit of like clunk and shuffle around to it. Brian cranks on the leg until the champ is able to sit up, twist around behind him and launch him with a German suplex.
Oh,
I don't think
lovely.
I've ever seen a German suplex that starts from a both men sitting position before. And then there's an Uranage back in the other direction that gets a two count. Danielson cuts Morishima off on the turnbuckles, can't get a superplex, but can avoid a top rope dropkick, and gets hold of that leg again, clamping on. It's a cross between a heel hold and the T part of the STF.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's got Morishima's legs in between his legs, and I kept thinking at any moment he's gonna drop the foot, clamp the legs together, and go down into the face bar part.
Mm.
And he doesn't. He's just clinging onto that leg and squeezing it and twisting it.
Just at that point, I think you can really start to feel the desperation from Brian, both from an actual "I need to kind of keep on Morishima," and then Morishima, any chance he gets, if Brian gets a bit tired. Like, you can feel that Morishima's hits are hitting that bit harder. Mm. It's the desperation because both, oh my God, my eye is killing me, but also I need to get this done, but also I need to take my opportunities when this guy is down to keep him down for as long as possible.
They do mention on commentary that targeting the leg is something that none of the previous challengers have tried.
Student of the game.
Seems incomprehensible if he's had 15 title defenses before this and no one else has gone, oh, I'll kick this big fella's knee out.
I mean, I've read out the list of guys, and other than Roddy Strong, none of them are what I'd call sensible technicians, except for Nigel.
Yeah.
Nigel just did arms. He didn't do legs.
Strong's more of a back guy as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
The chiropractor, Roderick Strong. So they trade German suplex attempts, but each elbow out. Danielson hits the ropes but runs into a Fez press, which is basically just Morishima's belly smashing him in the face. Morishima has to be reminded to ground and pound the challenger while he has the mount. And like, this speaks to what you were talking about earlier, how he has to sort of be coerced into being meaner, I think. Mm-hmm. Danielson absorbs it, though. He rolls through into a half crab.
I love that. It's just really smooth and out of nowhere.
Mm. Morishima eventually kicks him off and they double down. Morishima slaps his knee awake, and as soon as Brian gets up, drops him again with a big boot. I really like the timing on that spot.
Mm.
Like, he's up just like half a second quicker than Brian and is able to get his foot up into his face to knock him down again. Dragon backflips out of the backdrop driver. Should mention, that's Morishima's finish here. And gets a two off a small package. I'm guessing this is after the unbreakable small package run?
Yeah. So the unbreakable small package run was in 2006.
That's what I thought.
And the main reason that Danielson did that was so that he could save it so that someone would kick out and it would be like a massive near fall. So he essentially was building to a near fall for months.
Yeah.
And the kick out in question was at Final Battle 2006, when Homicide kicked out of the small package and then very quickly afterwards beat Danielson with the cop killer.
Oh, I mean, it's still working here. Like, a sizable portion of the crowd still think this is going to be the finish.
Mm.
And then Morishima kicks out. He has a rolling elbow to the jaw, one to the back of the head, and a roll up to get another two count. And at this moment, I did get a chuckle off one of the commentators saying, "Brian has such a tight small package." I'm a child.
Oh, he was Mr. Small Package at one point
I bet. I bet. Danielson himself gets made considerably smaller and tighter when Morishima just sits down on a sunset flip, but still manages to duck a lariat and herk the big guy over with a bridging German suplex. I was very impressed that it was a bridge and not a release, given the size difference. When he doesn't get the win, he tries to hammer and anvil elbows, which will still be familiar to Brian Danielson fans today. Morishima tries to get Dragon onto his shoulders, but he can't. So Danielson goes to work on the knee some more, followed by the traditional kicking in of the fucking head. Danielson covers, and I loved how certain the crowd were that just pure persistence and erosion were going to be enough to get the pin. Like, it's not a big move. He's just battered and battered and battered, and now he's going to try and get the pin.
That was the Daniel Bryan style finish. So the 2006 run, the peak of it was he was a guy that had four or five different moves that won matches, and he would flow between move to move to move. So he'd flow from cattle mutilation to the hammer and anvil to the kicking in the heads. He had the small package. So wearing a guy down and, okay, that didn't do it, but will this do it? Will this do it? That was kind of peak top end Brian Danielson matches. So again, it's what the crowd are kind of like paying more attention than you normally would to a finishing stretch because they don't know what the finish could be.
Yeah, it's that's born like, out here. Like, we're in the middle of that sequence here. So now he goes to the cattle mutilation and this brings the crowd up even more. And like, they're sure that as he progresses through all his signature offense, as you say, all of which has won him matches before, that this one will be the one that wins. And I like that kind of escalation. So they do 2.5 drops of the arm in the cattle mutilation, and Morishima is able to shuffle back just enough to get his toes under the ropes to force a break. Danielson then thinks a back superplex is going to be a good idea. Listener, it was not. Morishima turns into it and crushes him as they hit the mat. It seemed like he was trying his hardest not to land too much on top of him, but
crushed him.
He still did.
And it looked amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it did.
Yeah, as Sarah said, it absolutely smushed him.
Yeah. So Danielson tries to fire up and fight through a barrage of strikes, but gets turned into a spinning top with another lariat for a two count. And then finally, the backdrop driver for the three. So I'm going to start with our guest. Where do you stand on this match? And what do you think has put this on the must-see matches list?
I think it's actually better now watching it with, you know, a few years on. I have so much more regard for it than I actually did, I think, when I first watched it. I think I'm not going to get into star ratings, but let's face it, it probably should have been 5 stars. I should have been rated 5 stars at the time. If we could go back and change things and could get on to Dave, I would do that.
For the record, it is 4.75 in The Observer and 9.37 on Cage Match.
ridiculous. And I think what really makes this match, and it's sad to say, is Brian's injury. Mm. And I think nowadays that wouldn't happen. I think people would intervene and stop the match in 2023. But because we're sick freaks who love wrestling and love that extra layer to a story, it really just enhances the match. And it adds, I love when there's just desperation, especially with wrestlers like Brian, him trying everything and him having, like we said, all those different finisher combinations and him flurrying through it just to try to beat this big man, his first time wrestling him. He's not sure actually which one's going to work. It's all new to him trying new strategies. And it's just a great match that does not feel like 20 minutes because of the pacing. I think the pacing is so Brian feeling him out, just trying to get a sense of what can I get away with? How quickly can I get attacks in on this guy? Yeah. And how hard is he going to hit me back? To then, you know, slow at the start, you have the big spot then after Brian gets his eye hurt with the dive to the outside, and it builds and builds and builds. And storytelling, I think, is one of the most essential parts of pro wrestling. And I think this is just a picture perfect way to do it. And in a nice, concise format that everyone can enjoy. You know, you can sit down and watch this at any time. It doesn't have to be this big 50 minute long epic. It's an epic in 20 minutes.
Mark, how about you?
I think one of the things that Sarah said about the thing that put it over was the damage and the real life injury. If you actually look at the three Brian Danielson matches that were basically, we're going to talk about on the list, all of them have an injury element to them.
I mean, it's Brian Danielson. He's currently out with a broken arm.
Yeah.
After a big match.
Yeah. I mean, and the one that isn't the Brian Danielson injury, you know, the match, you know, the injury.
Oh yeah.
We'll discuss it when we get there. Concussions.
And just to tee people up and get them into a frothing frenzy for that, I've never seen that match and I'm not going to watch it until the week we do the show.
Have you seen Danielson versus Kenta?
I have seen a Danielson versus Kenta match, but did they have more than one singles in Ring of Honor?
Yes, I imagine you will have seen the 2006 one rather than the 2007 one.
I couldn't tell you exactly which one I've seen. I have seen a Brian Danielson versus Kenta Ring of Honor singles match, yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm kind of with Sarah here in that I think this is, I wouldn't say this is my favorite Brian Danielson singles match. I think that might be the Kenta one.
Okay.
But what I'll say is this is a match where it's like, I think hands down, this is Morishima's best title defense to this point. And bear in mind that Morishima was a very polarizing Ring of Honor champion. There's some people that loved his reign and there's some people that absolutely hated it.
I'm kind of aware, like, I have memories of that from the time, even though I wasn't really watching this.
Yeah. And I just really like this match as it's got that building flow. It's a clear big man, little man match, which is not something that you got too much in Ring of Honor because, honestly, they didn't have many big men.
I'm just looking at the match before this was Claudio Castagnoli versus Chris Hero, who were each about 6'4". Carry on.
I mean, they didn't wrestle as like big men, especially Hero at that time.
No, they were two giants trying to do lucha quite a lot of the time, I suppose.
Yeah. You had that element. You had, I don't know how many matches to this point had begun with that much just kicking someone's leg repeatedly. That's something that stands out. That then builds, and that's a through line through the match. You've got the Danielson finishing stretch, which I absolutely love. And it kind of, it's a really good match. It builds really well. As Sarah said, it doesn't go too long. It doesn't wear your time out. It shows you why people love Brian Danielson. It also showed you kind of how hot those New York Ring of Honor crowds could be. And this is the good kind of hot, not when the crowd would just yell Twinkies all the time and just really be obnoxious.
Oh no, like that was something that actually impressed me for a mid-2000s American indie, particular Northeast crowd. At no point were they being assholes. They were into that match and they were I mean, there were some people cheering for Morishima, but they were into Brian Danielson.
I mean, I think they'd used their asshole coin earlier in the show, because earlier on the show was a Pac versus Davey Richards match, which was Davey decided to do a lot of Chris Benoit spots. And bear in mind, it had only been a couple of months before that, I think, at this point.
We should have known about him then. This is Pac's horror tour, isn't it? Like, he did the UK shows and got over like crazy.
Yeah.
Because he was in front of his
yeah. And then the night before this, he wrestled Danielson. And the problem with High Flyers wrestling Danielson, very rarely do the High Flyers actually get enough shine. I think Brian against High Flyers was a bit too focused on grounding, and the other guy didn't get the rub as much, and that was definitely a case with a Pac match.
Yeah, I think Danielson's go-to a lot of the time is ground my opponent, because that makes logical sense as a fighter.
Yeah.
Rather than as a pro wrestler, I need to let this guy shine before I ground him and work it into the story, I think.
Yeah. So, as you say, it
far
was Pac's
horror... Far be it from me suggesting Brian Danielson may have any shortcomings.
It was Pac's horror tour, and... Yeah. My friend whose wedding I went to, he bumped into Pac at the airport coming home.
Mm.
And I think I've said this story before. And Pac was almost in tears. He was like despondent because in his head, he'd ruined his big chance of getting into Ring of Honor. Now, history showed that his relationship with Dragon Gate was much, much more beneficial than any kind of Ring of Honor run would be.
I think Pac's done all right for himself.
Yeah, he's done all right for himself.
Mm.
He can even talk now.
if you can understand him.
Yeah.
So I kind of have a little bit of a devil's advocate-y type question. I will start with Sarah for an answer. Without the eye injury, is this still must-see? Is this only must-see, or is part of the must-see, look at what this guy can do with only one eye?
I think it is still must-see, and you kind of have to then give it to Morishima for such how he can actually give so much to Brian. Because I'd actually love for people to watch this and not know that he has an eye injury, first of all, because I actually don't know anyone who has watched it and didn't know about that.
Mm.
If anyone is watching this for the first time and didn't know about the injury, do say something. But I think this is really displayed Morishima's abilities in actually being able to be a monster who actually gives a lot to his opponent. And I think that actually then showcases the strength, because it kind of gives a lot more to his strikes and how effective they are, that he doesn't need to be laying them in for you know, having half the offense in a match. He can actually only have about 20-30% of an offense in a match and be far more effective with it than others can in the heavyweight division. And I think that's what really was showcased in this match. So I think, without the eye injury, I think it still does. I mean, maybe that's what pushes it to the 5 stars for me. Maybe without it, it is the 4.75. But definitely, I think it is still worthwhile feather in the cap of Morishima's title reign. And I've always been a big believer in Morishima. I think Ring of Honor needed something like that. Like, back to Mark's point at the beginning of the show, anyone who'd been champion up to that point was either a Ring of Honor guy or within the independent scene, maybe except for Xavier, but we'll kind of, that was early days. So I think this was actually needed, and something to not have Ring of Honor go stale. It brought fresh main events. It brought fresh thinking into how they can structure their matches and main events. So, and I think this match is the crown jewel of the title run, not the Jimmy Rave match.
Having Morishima as a champion probably did a reasonable amount for their profile in Japan as well, because they are now going to get their photos in the Japanese magazines, which are still important at this point, I think.
Yeah, and it was probably a factor in Ring of Honor then doing the shows in Japan. I can't remember if that was 07 or 08, the first Japan shows, but they did a show with Dragon Gate and a show with Noah.
Yeah.
I have the poster for that in my room somewhere, actually. I still have it somewhere.
Mark, still must see without the eye business?
Honestly, I'd possibly say no. It's maybe a bit harsh. It's the kind of, I did a Twitter poll a couple of days ago, just in general, basically asking strangers. I just put out the question, what are your three favorite Bryan Danielson ROH matches off the top of your head? And unsurprisingly, the top two were the Danielson at Unified, McGuinness at Unified, and Kenta at Glory Bar on a five night two, which spoilers are the other two matches that we'll be covering for Daniel Bryan from Ring of Honor. But the next two were this match, but before it was actually the end of their feud. And it was interesting to me that we nearly actually had the end of the feud as well. That was one vote off having enough nominations.
Okay.
And
I should have asked, actually. I'm so sorry. What other nominations did Morishima get?
Give me a second. Sorry, he didn't have
blindsided you with a question that should be at the start of the show, right near the end of the show. Keep him on his toes.
He only had one other match nominated.
And was it the other Danielson match?
It was the other Danielson match. It was the fourth and final Danielson versus Morishima matches. And I would actually say that while I'm not sure that I'd call this match must-see, I think if you viewed the feud as a whole, all four matches, because all four matches, if you watch them back-to-back, including entrances, is still less than 90 minutes.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic story, and I would argue it's the best feud. It's up there with the best feuds that Ring of Honor ever did, and I'd say it's Ring of Honor's best singles feud. Now, I say that a feud is different to a rivalry. A rivalry is about competition. So I would call Steamboat versus Flair, to me, that is a rivalry. Whereas a feud has that element of hate.
Flair versus Funk is a feud.
Yes.
Because Ricky Steamboat never tried to suffocate Ric Flair with a plastic bag.
So, as I say, Morishima only had one other. So it's a match that's in a lot of people's psyches, but I probably don't think it's must-see. It's definitely not on the level of the other two matches to me.
Okay.
And, but as I say, I really like this, and I definitely recommend people watch this and then watch the end of the feud, because the end of the feud is a fantastic match. And I'd argue it possibly is a bit better, but it doesn't have that injury element. But the whole feud is literally built out of Danielson's animosity at getting injured. So it's him seeking revenge and Morishima getting angry, and the matches just get more and more violent.
I'm looking at a YouTube thumbnail right now, which is those two staring down and a patch over Bryan Danielson's eye.
That was the second match in the feud.
So I am going to crawl down here, and I'm going to be the low man on this totem pole, I'm afraid.
I could tell.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I know the pro wrestler mentality for injuries, particularly independent wrestlers, particularly during this period. Carrying on wrestling a match for 20 minutes, only being able to see out of one eye, is a dumb thing to do, however you frame it. I think my enjoyment was hurt by knowing what was going to happen before I started watching it. Beyond that, I don't think this is must-see, with or without the eye injury. I'm sorry. I think it's a good main event level match that, unfortunately, while trying to cover for his shortcomings, accidentally exposes Morishima as not ready to be world champion yet. Like, I, as I said during my rundown, there were several spots where I noticed he looked hesitant or had to be moved into place or had to be reminded to do something by either Danielson or the referee. And that's not, I am ready to carry the work rate indie world champion level for me. I mean, there was a bit where it was like he was a kid who'd been thrown on stage and their parent is there going, go on, honey, just like we practiced at home. And that's what I felt like Bryan Danielson was in this match to him at some points. I get that he should be learning, and I get that he should be learning to use his size more aggressively and not be the cuddly teddy bear with the aggressively straightened hair. But I don't know if he needs to be world champion while he's doing it. So Sarah's probably disconnected from this call. What I really did like, though, I thought all the big stuff after the double down was very good. And I think that's where Morishima was more in his element, where he was able to just throw bombs and hurl this little man around and smack him really hard and go do the near fall stuff. And I really like the story of the smaller challenger trying a different strategy to all the previous challenges, and that works until it doesn't. So he's forced to run through his bag of tricks and eventually, essentially, just gets overcome by sheer size. I thought that worked really well. I cannot, in all good conscience, call this must-see. I would invite people to watch it. It's available on YouTube. I will link to it when this show goes out. But for me, had I seen this before nominations period, I would not have nominated it by any stretch, I'm afraid. Feel free to eviscerate me. That's what we're here for.
I actually understand, though, because that's why I'd love for people to watch it without knowing, like, the injuries and stuff like that.
I think it's hard to not know, though. Like, it's a pretty famous injury.
Exactly. Like, because I first watched it. Now, again, I watched it probably for the first time 14 years ago.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually know, because I was lucky to be in an environment where, like, my brothers are also getting into independent wrestling, so we were all watching these things for the first time together. So we didn't spoil each other on things, and we sat down and watched it for the first time. I actually think, though, if I was to watch it now for the first time, knowing without kind of my previous love for the match, my adoration for Morishima, and I probably have too much adoration for him, because I think it's a, we can get into a bit later, a sad story that his career was cut short. That I probably look at his stuff with slight roses tinted glasses, I'll admit. When I have favorites, I am slightly biased towards them.
I think it happens a lot. Like, your favorite anything, you're willing to overlook the flaws in it, I think.
Exactly. And I think that's what I do with this match. And that's probably why I love it so much. Because when I'm high on something, I am kind of, I'll glance over things. But if I was in your shoes, I would definitely pick up on the little things. If I'm not really feeling a match, or if I'm...
I should also point out that I am a natural details person and a natural nitpicker. I cannot help it.
And I think that's why this one can go either way for people.
I don't think it's bad by any stretch of the imagination, but for me, it's a 4-star, not a 4¾ or a 5.
Yeah, and I get that.
So, Sarah, if you are prepared to, would you like to kind of get us up to speed on what happened to Takeshi Morishima? Because I honestly don't know. Like, all I know is I don't see him anymore.
Yeah, so what happened in 2015, quite suddenly, he had to announce he was retiring because he was diagnosed with diabetes, and it was beginning to really affect his health and, of course, his career. And, you know, he said his goodbyes to Noah, and that was kind of it for a while. And whilst that was quite sad at the time, you know, if it was affecting his health, kind of so be it. But really, the sad part of the story is he actually announced in 2018 and made appearances at shows that he was announcing his return to professional wrestling. And this got people kind of whipped up into a frenzy, because I think in my opinion, Noah wasn't doing so hot at the time. And they needed someone like him, a big name, a big star, to come back and really make an impact. And then whatever happened, he made that announcement, there wasn't really much from him. And then just some really sad stories then came out about him getting really drunk in bars, you know, costing people, looking for money to pay his taxis home and that sort of thing.
He got arrested for punching a taxi driver because he refused to pay an 18,000 yen taxi fee.
Yeah, and then from there he disappeared.
Yeah, not heard anything.
Wow.
So Morishima dropped this title, the Ring of Honor title, in October 2007. He dropped it to Nigel. The story is that title defense was meant to be in the UK, with McGuinness winning in front of a UK crowd in October. Ring of Honor and Alex Shane had fallen out by that point, so that tour didn't happen.
Yep.
Also, probably the pound dropping against the dollar didn't help either, because that was around 2007, 2008.
Right.
And The reason ROH went to the UK in the first place was because they got a lot of money from people buying DVDs because the pound was strong against the dollar.
Yeah.
So you could buy a lot of DVDs for your money. So in March 2008, Morishima beats Misawa for the GHC heavyweight title.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Morishima getting his chance to be the top guy. He gets a 6-month reign, and then Noah does what Noah does, which is panic and drop the belt back to an established veteran. So yeah. Kensuke Sasaki had the title, then Jun Akiyama had it after Sasaki, and then Noah's like, well, we've tried Rikio, that didn't work. We've tried Marufuji, that didn't work. We've tried Morishima, that didn't work. So they try Go Shiozaki. Now, Morishima will get another title reign for a year in 2012-2013. And he was at a decent level. Mm. He was probably one of the top guys. Bear in mind, by this point, Kobashi's retired. I can't remember if this was the time that Akiyama and Shiozaki left to join All Japan. It might have been after, but it was around about that period. Mm-hmm. So it was Morishima and Kenta were like the top dogs. And then not far after this, Kenta went to WWE. So Morishima was like near the top of the card, but I think it says a lot that if you look at cage match, I can't see any like post 2010 Morishima matches with like high ratings.
Mm.
Morishima's top 10 on cage match is almost exclusively the Ring of Honor run. Now, admittedly, that's because cage match, I think, when it really got lots of people actually using cage match was like after this Noah run. In Morishima's top 30 matches, only 3 are after 2010. So it kind of says something about how much attention was paid to Noah and the strength of Noah around that point. Apologies if I'm dragging, but as Sarah said, it's a really tragic end to a career that never really hit the heights people thought it would, I think.
No.
Randomly had a dark match before a Raw taping. No, a live show.
I remember that story, yeah.
He just showed up and like randomly one evening in 2008 and everyone was like, what is going on here? So in an alternative universe, we wrestled 2 matches and gotten released 6 months later.
I'm just looking. So, 18th of August 2008, Takeshi Morishima defeats Charlie Haas in 3 minutes on a Monday Night Raw dark match. And then the next night, the SmackDown taping, he defeats Jamie Noble in a dark match.
Well, this was around the time when a lot of the comparisons for Morishima was Terry Gordy.
Mm.
And supposedly, after those Morishima matches, Michael Hayes, well-known, well-rounded individual, basically was absolutely angry because he saw Morishima and just went off, he's nothing like Terry Gordy, he's not blah, blah, blah.
Which, fair enough.
Yeah.
So, as mentioned, 4.75 in The Observer, 9.37 on Cage Match. Danielson versus Morishima, The Feud, finished second in Feud of the Year in the Observer Awards. Danielson won Most Outstanding, came second in Wrestler of the Year. Morishima was fourth in Most Improved and won Brawler of the Year. And this match was the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Match of the Year for 2007. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this match with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure. The floor is yours to tell people where you can be found on the internet if you want to be found, plug any projects you've got going on, anything like that.
Thanks. Yeah, so you can find me at Sarah Flan on Twitter. I'm not too active at the moment, but you never know. If the G1 kind of starts lighting a fire underneath me, I might start tweeting a lot more again about wrestling. And then just in terms of projects, I mean, we haven't been too active in a while, but if you want to ever hear me talk about some mid-2000s pro wrestling gorilla, you can find me at Journey Through Gorilla Island. We're up to about mid-2005 now, so there's quite a few shows there to check out. And lastly, just thank you for having me to talk about Bryan Danielson and Takeshi Morishima. It's been a lot of fun.
Excellent stuff. Yeah,
thank you.
As for us, you can go to linktr.ee/mustseematches for all the ways to subscribe, links to the full list of nominations and a whole load more stuff. Every month, I am on GCP with Andy Ogden, reviewing the 1999 horrific British wrestling television show UWA Wrestling Rampage, which is an experience, let me tell you. We are gearing up to record our final episode of that series very soon. You can get all that by going to @GCPPodcast1 on Twitter, or look for GCP Podcast on your podcast app of choice. We are at Must See Matches on Twitter, Instagram, Mastodon, and new for summer 2023 Threads, which I set up today. No idea if that's ever going to be a thing, but it's a lifeboat just in case Elon
puts Elon's
fucking drill in the hull of the good ship Twitter. I am at Kieran Edits, and Mark is
at Monkey_Buckles.
Next week, it's Brian Danielson. It's New York City, but it's 2021. In the most recent match we will cover on this podcast, we will talk Brian Danielson versus Kenny Omega from AEW Dynamite Grand Slam from September 22nd, 2021. And in the guest seat, the long-awaited, much-anticipated return of the star of Botchamania 472, Palm Singh Man. So that will be a wonderful time, I am sure. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.